I'm delighted now to welcome Margaret Atwood. She is the author of over 40 books of fiction, poetry, and prose. Her latest novel is The Year of the Flood. She, along with her partner, Graham Gibson, will be at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts on Monday, November 17th at 7 in the evening. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this novel is set in some time in the unspecified but not too distant future in which a viral pandemic has wiped out most of the human race. And those who survive were people who were isolated in one way or another. They were quarantined or in jail or whatever. As you wrote this novel, did you imagine it as an extrapolation of the present, but basically realism, or something, I know you don't like the term science fiction, but something more in that direction of fantasy?
I don't mind the term science fiction. I just like to have it used precisely. So if one does use it, one has to say which lineage of science fiction it belongs to, and it belongs to the lineage that began with Jules Verne writing about things that might possibly be invented and happen, and went on through 1984 and Brave New World and things like Ridley Walker and Death of Grass by John Wyndham. So things that could happen on this planet as opposed to a galaxy far, far away, or invasion by squid-like monsters and tin cans. So there are two lines of it. So I'm of the first line, and you can call it science fiction if you want, but you have to then put a little subset saying this kind. Anyway, could it happen? No question. We have all of the tools for such an event in our hands right now, and that would be the fact that we've cracked the DNA code, and students and universities are happily now slicing and dicing to make little viruses of their own. So it's entirely conceivable. Will it happen? Well, not necessarily, because we have invented the hydrogen bomb and we haven't yet blown all of ourselves up with it. So we don't always use our edge tools destructively as soon as we've got them. But is it possible? Sure. As for the rest of the future in this book, we have those tools as well. So I wouldn't call it necessarily wild, made-up, deep, dark, gothic invention on my part. You might call it wild, inventive, deep, dark invention on the part of the human race who invents these things.
Right. The metaphor of the waterless flood has obviously biblical connotations, mankind being punished for their sins, and in this case the sins are in part ecological, or in very large part ecological. The tigers and the elephants and rhinoceroses.
Man-made species extinctions, which are going on right now. So whatever you may think of the cause of global warming, there is no doubt that the extinctions are being caused by us. So my group, called the God's Gardeners, take bits of scripture quite seriously, and like every other religious group, they cherry pick scripture to suit themselves and reinterpret it according to their own frame. But there's enough in there to support their views, for sure. And I don't know whether you know about the Green Bible yet, but it has made an appearance among us. It's got linen covers, it's got ecologically correct paper, it's got the green parts in green. It's got an introduction by Archbishop Tutu and a lot of green things that you can do at the end. And it takes the stewardship view as opposed to let's destroy it all, let it all burn, and God will make another one. So there are those two views right now on the planet, and there's already a green movement within Western North American Christianity, and some of the other world religions actually never lost their green roots. Let's mention Buddhism and Hinduism, and even the Quran, which is pretty specific about the rights of animals.
The God's Gardeners are a religion who have a theology that's really a fusion of scripture and science. And I have to say, it felt entirely plausible. Are there any groups that are doing this? Is this based on any actual religion?
I think it's going that way. It's a blend of science, religion, and nature. And some of the positions in Adam 1's sermonettes are not my own invention. They have a tradition behind them. So although some of the readings, for instance, not everybody would interpret the passage where Jesus says, come with me and I'll make you fishers of men. Not everybody would interpret that as care for the fish by removing two fishermen from the fisherman pool, but you might read it that way. Some of the other theological positions, however, have long tradition. So are there any groups that are going that way? I think increasingly Western Christianity, which separated from its green roots in the late 17th and 18th centuries when it was confronted by a mechanistic view of the universe, took the position that animals were basically machines. I think they are now reconnecting with their earlier, much greener roots. Go into any medieval cathedral, and what do you see? Carving around the pillars and on the pews and in the stained glass windows and decorations. You see a lot of creatures and plant life, because the inside of the cathedral was supposed to be a mirror of the universe, and that included everything that had been created. And the human scenes took place within that.
I think it's important and interesting that the way the book is set up, the way this religion is set up, there is no inherent conflict between religion and science, which is something that we are confronted with in our daily life, that the apparent opposition between those two things.
Well, it's not an opposition if you take the view that the word knowledge should apply to things that you can actually know and test, and the word faith should apply to things that you believe in. And I think one thing that happened to Christianity in the 19th century was that it went materialistic. It felt that it had to justify its beliefs in a materialistic way, in the same way that science was testing and proving things. And that simply removes meaning from the word faith. You know, if it's not a question of, if everything has to be a question of knowledge, then it has to be, you have to be able to submit it to a materialistic proof. Our gardeners take the opposite view. They say that things of the spirit are of the spirit, much as traditional Christianity has always said, and that spirits are not things. Therefore, any idea that you have to be able to measure spirits by electrical charges or spiritons or any other such device, that just goes out the window, because spirits are not material things. Don't you think that makes sense?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the Apostles' Creed says God is a spirit, right?
Right.
In other words, God isn't a thing. God doesn't
right.
have a body.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is, we're in this sort of ridiculously constructed, or I think ridiculously constructed, political situation in which you have...
Well, you have people denying physics, chemistry, geology, archaeology,
exactly.
Deep history, DNA. That's all part of the material world, and therefore subject to material proof. And they're insisting that material world is in fact the same as the world of faith.
So in this historical moment in which you and I are living and sitting here talking on the radio, it is possible to both deeply love humanity and deeply love the rest of the natural world and witness the one destroying the other. And when I was reading The Year of the Flood, I felt, I guess I have to say, little or no sadness about the decimation of the human race. It was almost a kind of relief. And
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well,
there is that uh-oh moment, and I have had people say similar things to me, and I think, boy, you know, unless we're willing to, there is another pathway, and that would be to change our ways now.
Exactly, but I mean, in the book, they haven't done that.
No, they haven't done it, no.
I mean, it's really, in a way, a call to us to be good gardeners, to be good guardians of life on Earth.
Well, if you want to continue, I mean, it isn't the whole natural world that man is going to succeed in destroying, because our human race is going to go before that happens. We are not going to be able to wipe out every microbe on the planet, but we are going to be able to do a pretty good job on ourselves.
Well, do you yourself feel that? I mean, when I thought, gosh, it's so good that most of them are gone, now the Earth can get back to its own business, I thought, boy, that's a pessimistic view. I mean, do you feel that way yourself?
Not really, because if I did feel that way, I wouldn't bother writing books, would I? Because what are books but human communication? So they're based on the idea that people can communicate with other people and that that's a worthwhile thing to do. And also, as I've gone about now in 7 countries talking about all of this stuff, you would be astonished at how much grassroots activity there is out there. The people on the ground are, in a way, way ahead of the politicians on this. And it goes everywhere from soil conservation to water conservation to green technologies being invented to local initiatives to nature conservancy. There's a lot of activity. Not enough, but there's a lot. So it's definitely it's growing in awareness and it's growing in activity. And people are getting involved on quite a scale. And I have to say, in connection with the God's Gardeners, that you don't do that simply for rational considerations. It has to be emotional. You don't put that kind of commitment into something unless you have an emotional attachment with that which you're trying to save.
We're talking to author Margaret Atwood about her new book, The Year of the Flood. The religion in the book is full of saints, and I loved the choice of saints. A lot of them were environmentalists, and some of them I'd never heard of, and some of them are very well known, Diane Fossey and Karen Silkwood, and I think
Rachel
Peter,
Carson, Rachel Al Gore. Gore.
Exactly.
E.O. Wilson.
But then some of them, was it your hope that we would stop reading for a moment and go look these people up?
If you wish, you can certainly do that. They're all online.
So St. Alexander Zawadzki, for example.
He's online.
A Polish communist of the early 20th century.
Well, he was a Polish environmentalist.
So they're basically all the saints are environmentalists of one kind or another.
They have to have had that. That's why they get to be saints. How they behaved in the rest of their life is not of much interest to the gardeners. It's only their environmental work or their work as naturalists that counts with the gardeners. So St. Francis is in there, of course, but only for his sermon to the fishes and things like that.
This book, I hope, will serve as a kind of vaccine against the disease of unrestricted corporate capitalism, I guess.
Well, it's when corporate capitalism and government become the same thing that you're really in trouble. Then you're really in trouble. It's what the Soviet Union was like, only kind of backwards. The government was the corporations, and in my book, the corporations are the government. But either melding of those things is really not good for ordinary citizens because they have no recourse. They've got no way of, they have no control over the media. They can't say, I'm being poisoned by the mercury in the water. They can't say any of that. They have no power to go up against it. So you don't want a combination of government and business in that way.
And not far off from where we are now in many living examples, obviously.
Well, when the big financial meltdown happened and governments started pouring their money into banks and automobile companies, I thought, I'm not sure you really want that to happen. But what was the choice?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like 1984, only with much more of a focus on the environment.
Well, 1984 was the Soviet Union model. That was when the governments are the businesses. And ours in this book, and the one that we find ourselves closer to at the moment, is the businesses are the government. So it's them calling, it's whoever's calling the shots.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is that the characters in this book, some of them are also in your previous novel, Oryx and Crake, which I now have to go read, but I was reading about that, and it's same time, some of the same people, different focus. Why did you choose to go back to that time and place okay. and set of characters.
My earlier work was done in the Victorian novel. Those novels were often quite long, and a lot of them are written in serial form. But they often had chapters called Meanwhile, or that began Meanwhile. And you knew when you came to the Meanwhile chapter that it was the same world. It was the same time frame, but it was other people in a different place. And you also knew that sooner or later, the people in the Meanwhile chapter were going to meet up with the people in the chapter you had just read. So there would be a meeting of those two characters, and they would all be of those two character sets, and they would all be worked in somehow. And so you might think of Year of the Flood as the Meanwhile chapter. It's the same time. It's a group that's going to converge with the characters in the other book, and there's a lot of overlap in their stories. So what I wanted to do was look at a different part of the map. Oryx and Crake takes place within the elite, within the very gated communities that are now the big corporate and scientific enterprises. They actually have walls around them, which they kind of do now. And the Year of the Flood involves people who are very much not the elite. In fact, they're in the places in that society which are the most violent, most lawless, most out of control, most impoverished places in the society.
And I suppose it's no coincidence that in the first one it's the men who are the main characters, and the second it's the women.
Well, again, we're looking at a different part of the society, and it's true that we follow two female characters. We also follow a male character, namely Adam One, who is the leader of the gardeners. We follow him and his group.
Well, we are just about out of time, but I want to thank you, Margaret Atwood, for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great, and thank you.
Margaret Atwood will be in Santa Fe along with her partner, Graham Gibson, and the two of them will discuss their newly published books, The Year of the Flood and The Bedside Book of Beasts, and that's on Tuesday, November 17th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts in Santa Fe. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, and there's also a benefit party beforehand. You can get tickets and more information by calling Carol Norton at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, or by going to wildearthguardians.org. The event is co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. And for our Albuquerque listeners, Margaret Atwood and Graham Gibson will be at Woodward Hall on the University of New Mexico campus on Monday, November 16th at 7 o'clock in the evening. Again, call Carol at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, for more information. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can listen to the podcast anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services at santafe.radiocafe.org. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.